They've got strong, small-d democratic institutions that won't buckle under pressure and are capable of responding to citizens' needs and desires. But in countries that lack strong, legitimate democratic governance, the discovery of oil generally leads to more trouble and more inequality. Back in 2002, around the time that Equatorial Guinea was being identified as a key potential supplier of U.S. oil imports, the American professor at the vanguard of these studies, Dr. Terry Carl, explained this to a group of government officials and oil executives. Without intervention of some sort, they should expect a reduction of the welfare of people in oil-exporting countries. It will provoke violence and unrest. It will lead to the violation of rights. It will lead to the destruction of the environment. It will buffer authoritarian rule. Terry Carl would sometimes tell people the story of how she began the study that led to her famous first book, The Paradox of Plenty. A long time ago, when I was looking for a dissertation topic, I went down to Venezuela to interview the founder of OPEC, a man named Juan Pablo Perez Alfonso, and I asked him some questions about the founding of OPEC. And he said to me, "Teresita, you know, you're such a bright young person. Why are you studying OPEC? Why don't you see what oil is doing to us, the oil exporters?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Oil is the excrement of the devil." So began Dr. Terry Carl's decades of study into why the citizens in big oil-producing countries like Venezuela and Angola and Iraq live in hot messes, while some others, such as Norway and the United States, do well. Professor Carl remained neutral on the properties of the commodity itself. "Oil in itself means nothing," she would say. "It's just a black, viscous liquid." But it was hard to forget the OPEC founder's words, or those of a former minister of oil for Saudi Arabia, a country that had, on paper, financially benefited from its vast oil reserves more than any other on the globe. Sheikh Ahmed Zaki Yamani, whose position made him one of the most powerful men on earth, had told Professor Carl, "All in all, I wish we'd discovered water." Equatorial Guinea was hardly the first country to fall under the spell of the resource curse, but the stark lifestyle contrast between Teodorin and the mass of Equato Guineans made for compelling new fieldwork. Teodorin's primary residence was the Oceanside Estate in Malibu, but he also spent a few months a year surrounded by his $22 million worth of artwork, including paintings by Degas, Gauguin, and Renoir, at his $100 million six-story mansion on L'Avenue Foch in Paris's 16th arrondissement, and a little time at his modest $7 million property in Cape Town, South Africa. Resource-cursed scholars could comb through the recent Senate report for highlights of Teodorin's spending in the previous 5 years. $330,173.96 for a Lamborghini Roadster, one of his three dozen luxury cars. $102,053.29 for home security. $82,900 for furnishings, $58,500 for a Bang & Olufsen home theater, installation included, $3,221.31 for a portable car wash machine, and, are they dishwasher safe, $1,734.17 for two wine glasses. Two. These expenditures hardly seemed beyond the family budget, considering that Teodorin's father, President Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbasogo, ranked 8th on Forbes magazine's list of the wealthiest world leaders. He was just ahead of Queen Elizabeth II. This was public record, after all. What wasn't a matter of public record at the time was that Teodorin had signed a contract for the construction of his most extraordinary and costly toy, what promised to be the world's second-largest yacht. There was a yacht called the Eclipse, owned by a Russian oligarch named Roman Abramovich, that would still dwarf Teodorin's floating palace. But the $380 million price tag for Teodorin's boat would far outstrip the total annual spending of his father's government on education and welfare programs in Equatorial Guinea. And it showed. Peter Mars, the journalist who had profiled the head of Russia's Lukoil, went on assignment in Equatorial Guinea more than a decade into the country's oil bonanza and returned with a grim report. Nearly half of all children under 5 are malnourished. Even major cities lack clean water and basic sanitation. The main hospital is a place for dying, not healing. The wards are dingy rooms with soiled mattresses and no medical equipment except for a couple of IV drips. Equatorial Guinea's president, Obiang the Elder, had paid no real electoral price for the accelerating degradation of living standards alongside the astronomical growth of state revenue. Teodorin's father had just won a fourth term with a little more than 95% of the vote. But Professor Carl's prediction that this sort of oil boom would provoke violence and unrest was dead on. President Obiang, whatever his political prowess, was prey to insecurities and always on the lookout for the next coup. The entirety of his armed forces, Army, Navy, and Air Force, was only about 1,500 men, poorly trained and untrustworthy in his eyes. The president's chosen personal guard was instead a cadre of 350 soldiers hired from Morocco, armed with the latest in German assault rifles. But the increasing necessity of safeguarding all the new oil production facilities was well beyond the capacity of the Equato-Guinean military and President Obiang's rented security guard. That recognized fact had attracted an American mercenary firm led by a group of retired U.S. officers. The greatest corporate assemblage of military expertise in the world, the mercenaries' publicity team claimed. In February 2010, MPRI, Military Professional Resources Initiative, which had been acting as the Equato-Guinean Coast Guard off and on for about a decade, was surreptitiously awarded a new $250 million contract to provide added assistance to the Obiang administration. The contract, as explained by one defense industry trade publication, was to establish a network of surveillance sites and operation centers at different points along the country's coast to protect against piracy and other maritime concerns that exist in the region. The deal had to be approved by the U.S. government. And it was. Because, as President Obama's State Department explained, it was consistent with our foreign policy goal of ensuring maritime security in the Gulf of Guinea. Even with the increased sense of security that comes with American-trained firepower, President Obiang continued to live by that old saw, keep your enemies close, and by his own corollary to that old saw, and under guard. Many of his political opponents over the years had ended up in Black Beach Prison, an interrogation and detention center just a few miles down the road from the presidential palace. The happenings at Black Beach included stringing up prisoners like a marlin at the weight scale, waterboarding, electric shocks to the genitals, isolation, routine beatings, and starvation, according to an American economist working in the country early in Obiang's reign. The leaders of one failed coup were reportedly handcuffed around the clock, deprived of food, drink, sleep, and medical attention, and beaten relentlessly for 10 days straight until one tight-mouthed conspirator died of a heart attack. In 2010, around the same time the U.S. granted the new license to the corporate mercenaries at MPRI, the State Department also itemized President Obiang's activities in its annual report on human rights. Increased reports of unlawful killings by security forces, government-sanctioned kidnappings, systematic torture of prisoners and detainees by security forces, arbitrary arrest, detention, and incommunicado detention, judicial corruption and lack of due process, restrictions on the right to privacy, restrictions on freedom of speech and of the press, restrictions on the rights of assembly, association, and movement, violence and discrimination against women, suspected trafficking in persons, discrimination against ethnic minorities, restrictions on labor rights. That said, the State Department assured reporter Ken Silverstein separately, that MPRI contract includes an important human rights component and anti-trafficking provision, and we believe this training is a strong tool for tangible improvement in human rights and transparency. Yes, let's definitely invest our hopes in improving human rights and transparency in Equatorial Guinea to a contract with an armed mercenary group. Why not? Sounds bulletproof. Whether training in human rights and proper penal practices was high on President Obiang's list of priorities was hard to say, but he was certainly motivated to up his public relations game in the United States. In 2010, the government of Equatorial Guinea signed $1 million a year contract with Lanny Davis, an old friend of Bill Clinton turned lobbyist. The Democrats, of course, were back in power. The contract was to promote Obiang's interests in the United States. At press events designed to reintroduce President Obiang and smooth his global image, Lanny Davis tried humor. I've kidded him he'd do better to win with 51% than 98%. Also, pathos. President Obiang feels very vulnerable, without any friends. Aw, sad. Obiang also hired Corvus Communications, an up-and-coming public relations firm specializing in lipstick-on-a-pig operations for unsavory dictators and potentates around the world, like helping the Saudi royal family clean up all that bad press after 9/11. Corvus didn't have a lot to work with where Obiang's reputation was concerned. There was a little soundbite from a 2006 event in Washington where then-Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice called President Obiang a good friend. There was the photo Obiang and his favorite senior wife managed to get with President and Mrs. Obama in a receiving line at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in September 2009. There was also a recent State Department cable noting, inexplicably, President Obiang's mellowing, benign leadership. The Corvus flax could maybe point out Teodoro Obiang's exemplary tennis game, his valiant ongoing battle with prostate issues, his $3 million donation to fund the UNESCO Obiang Ngema Embosogo International Prize for Research in the Life Sciences, and his new public promise to begin investing more of his country's oil revenue in the general welfare of his people. When a pair of young aces from Corvus sat down with Ken Silverstein in the summer of 2010 to make the case for President Obiang, they insisted the talk of human rights abuses was greatly exaggerated. The capital city of Malabo was as safe a place as you'd want to visit, they suggested, in a head-spinning non sequitur. We could walk around at night and talk with people and no one interfered with us, Corvus's Matthew J. Lauer told Silverstein over cocktails at a downtown Washington bar. No one is saying there are no problems, but it's not North Korea. You play the hand you're dealt. If it's not North Korea is one of your best cards, go ahead, play it. The shopaholic son of President Obiang was also tough to explain or excuse, but since Teodorin was reportedly paying Corvus an added $55,000 a month to polish his own personal reputation in the wake of the recent bad press, they played his hand too. The Corvus fellows reminded Silverstein that Teodorin's lifestyle was similar to that of dozens of other public officials and scions from oil-rich countries such as Nigeria and Saudi Arabia. As the pitch went, Teodorin was being unfairly singled out. Corvus reminded Silverstein that Teodorin was still a young man sowing his wild oats, kind of like George W. Bush before he got serious about life and governance. President-in-waiting Teodorin, Corvus execs assured Silverstein in the summer of 2010, is at the point where he's thinking about his legacy. Actually, what Teodorin was mostly thinking about just then were his upcoming plans for serious high-end retail therapy, which took some special doing in the summer of 2010. Having been tagged by U.S. financial regulators as a politically exposed person from a notoriously corrupt country, Teodorin had to take extra precautions. He employed a special agent to do his bidding anonymously. Please make sure that Minister Obiang's name does not appear anywhere, the intermediary explained to Julian's Auctions. He should be invisible. Then, Teodorin, wearing this cloak of invisibility, executed an enthusiastic shopping spree at three separate live celebrity memorabilia auctions. Before 2010 was over, Teodorin had made winning bids on millions of dollars worth of things his lost would-be friend, the King of Pop himself, had touched, worn, or maybe at least gazed upon. Among the items Teodorin bought for his personal amusement were sculptures and porcelain figurines from Michael Jackson's Neverland Ranch, a Jackson 5 gold record, $1,500, a bag signed by Jackson and Paul McCartney, $3,000, a football signed by Jackson and Troy Aikman, $4,000, Jackson's gold record for Beat It, $10,000. Jackson's personal MTV Moon Man, $50,000. A pair of Jackson's crystal-studded socks, $80,000. Four of Jackson's fedoras, one of them signed and two of them stage-worn, $187,500. A basketball signed by Jackson and Michael Jordan, $245,000. And the coup de grace, the rosebud of the lot, that Swarovski Lacrosse crystal-covered glove worn by Mr. Jackson on his 1987 Bad Tour. $275,000. He won them all. When the first invoices from Julian's auctions arrived in Malibu, Teodorin instructed they be returned to sender and revised to reflect the billing party and address as one Amadeo Olui, Malabo, Equatorial Guinea, a.k.a. definitely not Teodorin. The payment of $1,398,062.50 to settle the bill from the first auction alone was promptly paid from a bank account in Equatorial Guinea. The total of Teodorin's 2010 Julian's auctions bill, it is worth noting, would have covered the living expenses of about 3,300 of his fellow countrymen for an entire year, given the fact that three-quarters of the population of Equatorial Guineans lived on $2 a day, just as they had 5 years earlier, and 10 years earlier, and even 20 years earlier, when their vast and valuable oil and gas reserves were still tucked away, unknown and unrealized, well below the ocean floor. Chapter 9. Practical Realities. Equatorial Guinea's main landmass is a little square the size of Vermont on the west coast of Africa, just north of the equator, that looks to have been carved out of the larger nation of Gabon. The national capital, Malabo, is actually on an island, on Bioko Island, which is about the size of Maui. It sits about 150 miles across the Gulf of Guinea from the country's largest mainland coastal city. Equatorial Guinea won its independence from Spain in 1968 and thereafter found itself at the tender mercies of the extended Obiang family. Francisco Macias Nguema, the country's first president, guarded his new position with a fierce and lethal jealousy. His security team is estimated to have killed or driven away more than a third of the country's citizenry during his 11-year reign. President Macias, who billed himself as the leader of steel, the implacable apostle of freedom, and divine miracle, and woe be to anyone who snickered upon hearing it, remarked one foreign diplomat. He made examples of some of his political opponents by having them crucified in public view. Macias was also notorious for a mass murder of his political foes in a soccer stadium, in which the public address system blared the song, "Those Were the Days," to drown out the dying screams of the victims. The CIA's World Factbook is typically terse on the subject. In the 11 years after independence, Equatorial Guinea's first autocratic ruler virtually destroyed all of the country's political, economic, and social institutions. Teodorin Obiang's father, Teodoro, served out most of those years at the pleasure of his uncle, President Macias. Among other things, Lieutenant Colonel Obiang had been in charge of the notorious Black Beach prison and its torture-happy Black Beach parties. One German publication described Lieutenant Colonel Obiang's cruelty thus: prodded with red-hot iron bars, prisoners were forced to dance around a fire for hours, singing songs of praise to President Macias, a.k.a. the leader of steel. In 1979, Lieutenant Colonel Obiang ran a bloody coup against his uncle and took over the presidency for himself. President Obiang has operated since, according to international consensus anyway, as a less malevolent figure than Mr. Divine Miracle, but force and terror still have reigned. In 1994, when John Bennett, the American ambassador in Malabo, called out President Obiang on his ugly human rights record, the diplomat received a very distinct reply from Obiang's crew, tossed at the ambassador from a moving car: "You will go to America as a corpse." The Obiang regime started tailing Bennett around the capital and officially accused the ambassador of employing witchcraft against President Obiang. The Clinton administration hastily pulled up diplomatic stakes and closed the U.S. embassy in Malabo. On his way out of town, in his farewell address, Bennett named the Obiang regime's top torturers one by one. But neither Obiang nor the handful of international oil companies already operating in Equatorial Guinea were much concerned. One oil executive had already screamed at Bennett, as the ambassador remembered it, for making it difficult for his company to do business. By the early 1990s, Western oil companies were ramping up production at the Zafiro oil field off the country's coast. With or without any political, economic, and social institutions, tiny Equatorial Guinea was about to take a cannonball leap into the international commodities market. Whatever the challenges were that President Obiang found so insurmountable when it came to providing potable water or education or roads or basic democracy to his citizens, he found all the authority and organization he needed to make it easy for oil producers to do business in his country. There was a very clear path to winning the right to drill off the coast of Equatorial Guinea, and it ran right through the presidential palace in Malabo. In a place like Equatorial Guinea, that longtime industry watcher Ken Silverstein explained in an interview with Mother Jones magazine, it's whoever figures out how to give the president and his inner circle the most money gets the contract. And that's how the black gold, the excrement of the devil, the natural resources, whatever you want to call it, the giant pots of oil under the seabed in Equatorial Guinea, ended up producing giant pots of money for the Obiang family. Start with an already ruthless dictator, divorced from international norms and unmoved by opprobrium for his human rights record. Now add oil company bribes and oil revenues to make that dictator suddenly wildly wealthy, with billions of dollars worth of new incentives to not just hold on to power, but to hold on to every single lever of power in the country to ensure the continued flow of oil revenue directly to and through him, with no political competitors horning in on the action. And bingo, the God-given resources of an entire nation become the private wealth of one family. From the oil company's perspective, that kind of arrangement is no muss, no fuss. If all the decisions on oil development are made by the president, all the bribing is a one-stop shopping experience. There was no government body in Equatorial Guinea capable of checking Teodoro Obiang or even questioning him. And he did not feel a compelling need to press Western oil companies for good deals on behalf of his citizenry. I mean, it's not like he was looking to fund universal pre-K. Where the ministers in most oil-producing countries in Africa might demand anywhere from 50 to 90% of a foreign company's locally generated revenue, Obiang was happy to settle for a third or a quarter or even 15%. As one International Monetary Fund report put it, Equatorial Guinea has by far the most generous tax and profit-sharing provisions in the region. Despite the going-home-as-a-corpse threat to the allegedly witchy last U.S. ambassador, President Obiang ended up being especially friendly to representatives of American business. And he had even more reason to be after the 9/11 attacks, when the United States was suddenly parched for imports from anywhere that was not the Middle East. In 2001, the United States produced a bit fewer than 6 million barrels of oil a day and consumed a little more than 19 million. This was the time, remember, when the Bush administration started wooing President Putin with promises to build Siberian pipelines and other infrastructure so the U.S. could buy more oil from Russia. Latin America might be good for more, and Africa, too, was a big, barely tapped newcomer on the horizon. In January 2002, 4 months after 9/11, California Republican Congressman Ed Royce spoke to a symposium of oil executives, U.S. government officials, academics, and envoys from several African countries. He said, "It's occurred to all of us that our traditional sources of oil are not as secure as we once thought they were. Oil is where you find it. Oil companies cannot always invest in democratically governed countries. It would be ideal if it could be guaranteed that the head of an African country where a U.S. oil company invested was in fact an advocate of democracy and always respected human rights. Unfortunately, that is not a realistic expectation." His Democratic colleague, Louisiana Congressman William Jefferson, concurred, but he saw possibility. "While there may be strivings and failings in Africa over democracy, in the Middle East, there's not even talk of it. Talk about democracy does not even part the lips of those who are in charge in those countries. So in Africa, there's at least a chance for the kinds of things we talk about here. Rule of law, for transparency. There's a chance for us to overcome some of the issues of bad governance through democratic influences." Congressman Jefferson's personal democratic influence would include soliciting hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of bribes from companies seeking to do business in Africa. $90,000 cash was discovered wrapped in aluminum foil in the congressman's icebox. That most notorious case of freezer burn in national history would ultimately send Congressman Jefferson to federal prison for 5 years. Just 2 weeks after that January 2002 African oil colloquy, a group of 50 men and women, including investors, oil company executives, and a handful of State Department officials, hosted President Obiang at a luncheon at the Army and Navy Club in Washington. This was a far cry from his visit to Washington just a year earlier, when Obiang had found it difficult to get an audience with an Assistant Secretary of Agriculture. At the Army and Navy Club that day, according to contemporaneous reporting by Silverstein, one oil executive raised a toast to the future of Equatorial Guinea. "It will be the Kuwait of Africa," he said. "It's a fabulous country." Another presented Obiang with a wooden letterbox and then thanked the officials from the State Department for pressing their bosses to reopen the U.S. Embassy in Malabo. President Obiang knew what was expected of him that day. He told the gathering that he hoped for an even larger and more energetic presence of American oil companies in his country. And he rolled out the welcome mat for businessmen and investors from the oil-hungry United States. "We can promise American companies," he said, "that their investments are guaranteed." The floodgates opened after that general bargain was struck. As the authors of a Pulitzer Center study would succinctly put it, the United States wouldn't openly criticize the regime, and the regime guaranteed the U.S. oil industry near exclusive access to the country's national oil reserves. Every Saturday morning, a Houston Express flight arrived in Malabo, nonstop from Texas, carrying a new cadre of oil workers. The gated and guarded residential areas swelled with Americans. The amenities included company-provided water and electricity and cell phone service. The American roughnecks drove their trucks over to local bars like La Bamba and Shangri-La, where they could buy Budweiser or Michelob or Coors, just like back home. Equatorial Guinea's Independence Day parades suddenly featured lines of American flags and a host of banners and placards festooned with the names and trademarks of Halliburton, Chevron, Marathon, ExxonMobil. The country's annual oil production nearly quadrupled in just 5 years. ExxonMobil was the biggest player in the Equato-Guinean offshore oil game by far. Its take from Equatorial Guinea grew to represent nearly 10% of ExxonMobil's total production worldwide. In thanks and in return, CEO Tillerson and ExxonMobil made sure President Obiang, his family, and his cabinet were well compensated. Very well compensated. What happened to the money after ExxonMobil wrote the checks was not of particular concern to anybody at the company. "We are private investors," said an Exxon spokesman in 2005, "and it is not our role to tell governments how to spend their money." What the execs at ExxonMobil did know and did bear in mind at all times was that Obiang owned the toll booth all oil companies had to go through in Equatorial Guinea. But it was the only toll booth, and his price was not particularly onerous, given the amount of money they were sucking up onto those offshore platforms. Why look that gift horse in the mouth? Frank Ruddy, who had been an attorney for Exxon in the 1970s and then ambassador to Equatorial Guinea in the 1980s, told Ken Silverstein, "Their concern is getting oil out of the ground with as little trouble as possible. Their first priority is not going to be that there's a democratic government. That's not their business, and it shouldn't be." But somebody was, thankfully, following that money. Most of it was flowing into Riggs Bank, headquartered right around the corner from the White House in Washington. President Obiang's other favored son, Gabriel, would sometimes explain that the State Department recommended that bank as a safe spot to keep the money. Gabriel told Peter Marse, "We wanted to make sure that American companies feel comfortable." Well, Riggs certainly felt comfortable. At one point, the bank was holding as much as $700 million in various accounts controlled by Obiang, his hand-picked government officials, and family members like Gabriel and Theodorin. The primary account into which ExxonMobil, Marathon, Hess, and others deposited their royalty payments was controlled by President Obiang himself. The source of other deposits was not always easy to trace. On two separate occasions, the Riggs Bank vice president managing the Equatoguinean accounts hied himself to the country's embassy a mile away, where he received suitcases full of $3 million in shrink-wrapped $100 bills, and then hauled the 60-pound package back to the Riggs Bank vault. "Where is this money coming from?" another Riggs vice president wrote to colleagues. "Oil," he said. "Black gold. Texas tea." A U.S. Senate investigation, sparked largely by Silverstein's early reporting, uncovered some financial transactions that looked to be uncomfortably close to the boundaries of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, a 1977 law that makes it illegal for Americans doing business abroad to bribe officials of other countries. ExxonMobil was by no means the only oil company that faced these kinds of accusations at the time, but the firm did stand out among its peers for what appeared to be its remarkably generous application of emoluments. According to the Senate investigation and follow-up reporting, ExxonMobil cut President Obiang in on an oil distribution joint venture that enriched him by about $640,000 on a $2,300 investment. The company paid Obiang's senior wife at least $365,000 in questionable rental fees. It paid Obiang's brother about $700,000 for security. An ExxonMobil spokesman explained to Senate investigators the company was pretty sure that this was market rate. It paid Obiang's interior minister $236,160 on a labor contract, and the Minister of Agriculture $45,000 for a rental house. ExxonMobil was unable, or maybe unwilling, to promptly deliver to the committee the complete list of payments made to Equatoguinean officials or Obiang family members. There were, after all, 500 separate contracts to comb through. "The business arrangements we've entered into have been entirely commercial," Andrew Swiger, ExxonMobil executive vice president, explained to a roomful of senators at a public hearing. "They are a function of completing the work that we are there to do, which is to develop the country's petroleum resources and, through that and our work in the community, make Equatorial Guinea a better place." Answereth Senator Carl Levin to that statement, "Make it what?" "I know you're all in a competitive business," Levin said, "but I've got to tell you, I don't see any fundamental difference between dealing with Obiang and dealing with Saddam Hussein." Riggs Bank took the big bullet, or more like the bunker buster. The venerable old financial institution that had dated from the President Andrew Jackson era and took a measure of credit for funding the Mexican-American War and the construction of the Capitol Dome and the purchase of Alaska is now no more. After paying enormous fines in the aftermath of the Equatorial Guinea bribery, corruption, and money laundering investigation, Riggs was sold on the cheap. The once glorious 42,000-square-foot marble Riggs Bank building, constructed in 1902 when Teddy Roosevelt was president, with regal Ionic columns and a view of the White House, was bought just a few years ago by the family foundation of the junk bond felon Michael Milken, and will soon be part of a conference center and museum dedicated to, you guessed it, finance and entrepreneurship. The Senate's final 2004 report on the Riggs Bank money laundering episode did oh so gently rebuke ExxonMobil and its brethren. Oil companies operating in Equatorial Guinea may have contributed to corrupt practices in that country. But even with the scandal and the implosion of Riggs Bank, 5 years later, things were still pretty much business as usual in Equatorial Guinea. President Obiang continued to hold power and control the money. And the shopaholic president-in-waiting had refused to trim his sails. "Lesser kleptocrats might have turned tail and fled," Ken Silverstein wrote, "but not Teodorin. He employed two lawyers to set up new shell companies and associated bank accounts that he controlled, but on which his name never appeared." And while Teodorin luxuriated in Michael Jackson's fedoras and socks and crystal sequined glove and porcelain figurines, ExxonMobil kept on doing what it had to do to keep the oil pumping out of the Gulf of Guinea. The world's most profitable corporation was still at pains to, as Rex Tillerson would say, communicate to the public and policymakers the complexities of the energy business in ways that help them better understand some of the issues involved and why things are how they are. When Human Rights Watch asked for comment on business practices in Equatorial Guinea in 2009, the other oil companies were quite circumspect. They explained their rigorous Foreign Corrupt Practices Act compliance program and their well-circulated business conduct and ethics code and their highest standards of ethical conduct and their compliance with the letter of and the spirit of applicable laws in the countries where we operate. ExxonMobil, though, like the man at the helm of the corporation, was merit badge calm and actually happy to explain in greater detail exactly why things are the way they are. Kenneth P. Cohen, ExxonMobil's vice president of public affairs, wrote this to Human Rights Watch. The practical realities of doing business in developing countries are challenging. Equatorial Guinea, like many developing nations, has a limited number of local businesses and a small population of educated citizens. As a result, there is a small community of government officials and business owners. Not unexpectedly, many of those persons are connected by a network of social and family relations. Many businesses have some family relations with a government official, and virtually all government officials have some business interests of their own or through a close relative. While we can assure you that ExxonMobil and its affiliate in Equatorial Guinea take the utmost care to conduct our operations in a legal, ethical, and above-board manner, for competitive reasons, we do not provide the details of our business activities. We do not provide the details of our business activities. Sort of says it all. By 2010, that oft-repeated phrase, see ExxonMobil public relations team template, it represented almost a century's worth of standard operating procedure for big oil. Oil, after all, is where you find it. Sometimes American corporations had to make deals with unsavory sorts to get at it, sure. But remember, even with domestic energy production on the rise in 2010, thank you fracking, the United States still needed to import about half of the crude oil it consumed. The oil companies could always make the claim, with that actual fact as evidence, that they were doing it for us. Everywhere they operate on Earth, oil and gas companies are incentivized to push as far as they can on extraction. That's how they make their money. And to escape negative consequences caused by that extraction. That's the basic math that produces their profit, their market share, their stock price, and the happiness of their shareholders. Because oil and gas are found all over the freaking place, though, oil and gas companies need a rudimentary foreign policy to maximize shareholder happiness by maximizing their ability to produce their product. And it turns out, rationally and understandably, the foreign policy priorities of the oil and gas industry are stability, access, control, simplicity. Countries may come and go, but oil and gas companies need to think bigger than that. They make big, expensive investments that cost a ton up front, and they need to be assured they'll be able to collect the promised payoff after all that work and expense. So the longer the relevant foreign ruler is in power, the better. And if the local autocrat is happily on the payroll, nobody's going to bother anyone about cleaning up any mess that oil production might cause in his country. And if any of the citizens of that country do step out of line and make a fuss, the ruling family and its well-paid paramilitary forces and its expensive PR firms will take care of that too. And everybody else will look the other way. That global system of anti-governance driven by Western energy companies, that corporate shadow foreign policy, persists year in and year out as American presidencies come and go. But occasionally, its costs become too much to ignore. By 2009, two important American politicians had decided that the costs of looking the other way in Equatorial Guinea were too high. Senator Richard Lugar, the Indiana Republican, and Senator Ben Cardin, the Maryland Democrat, didn't appear at a glance to have a lot in common. Lugar was a six-term senator and a former Rhodes Scholar with the calm demeanor of an old-school Midwestern patrician. Cardin was a first-termer, grandson of Russian Jewish immigrants, graduate of a state law school. He had a gait and cadence earned on the streets of Baltimore. They were both, however, increasingly fed up with the status quo, especially after Lugar's staff finished a long investigation that resulted in a 125-page Senate Foreign Relations report titled The Petroleum and Poverty Paradox, Assessing U.S. and International Community Efforts to Fight the Resource Curse. The excrement of the devil part was only implied. As Lugar wrote in an introductory letter to that report, too often, oil money that should go to a nation's poor ends up in the pockets of the rich, or it may be squandered on the trappings of power and massive showcase projects instead of being invested productively and actively. The resource curse, Luger noted, affects us as well as producing countries. It exacerbates global poverty, which can be a seedbed for terrorism. It dulls the effect of our foreign assistance. It empowers autocrats and dictators. And it can crimp world petroleum supplies by breeding instability. Luger's study took the measure of oil-rich, governance-challenged countries in Africa, Asia, Europe, Latin America, and the Middle East. His solution was elegant and straightforward. Transparency. Companies operating in extractive industries, from oil to diamonds, needed to provide the details of their business activities in foreign nations. And the countries needed to be more open about reporting what money came into state accounts and how it was spent. When oil revenue in a producing country can be easily tracked, Luger wrote, that nation's elite are more likely to use revenues for the vital needs of their citizens and less likely to squander newfound wealth for self-aggrandizing projects. Luger then introduced the Energy Security Through Transparency Act. The legislation required companies in the extractive industries to make an annual report of all payments they made to foreign governments for the purpose of commercial development of oil, natural gas, and minerals. Ben Cardin signed on as a lead co-sponsor. This was a bipartisan bill, Cardin later explained. Senator Luger's interest in this was solely because he believes in transparency and he believes in good governance. Cardin believed that transparency would improve the bang we got for our foreign aid bucks and act as a hedge against corruption. The United States spends the most on soldiers and weapons than any country in the world, Cardin said. If we had less corruption in the world, we would need a smaller budget on soldiers and weapons. The legislation eventually got a dozen more co-sponsors, Republican, Democrat, and Independent. But it didn't make it out of the Banking Committee before the end of the year recess. So Luger and Cardin cleverly got it attached as an amendment to a legislative juggernaut of 2010, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, which was the administration's best effort to curtail the financial shenanigans that had led to the epic near collapse of the world economy just before Obama's election. Cardin's public explanation for putting what became known as Section 1504 in the Wall Street bill was so investors can make intelligent decisions based upon the information on the companies they're being asked to invest in. And yes, that was a bit of a fig leaf, but it also made sense. Look at the squandered resources, an investment industry trade group spokesman said at an event with Cardin. Our interest as investors is to gain access to data, hard numbers, to evaluate risk. That's the business that we're in. And there are hardly any more acute sources of risk in the extractives industry globally than those connected with corruption around revenue payment. So there's this, for us, happy coincidence here, a convergence of interests with civil society. The co-founder of Global Witness, a group that had been pushing for transparency for a decade, liked that Section 1504 put the onus on both government and business. It takes two to tango, Simon Taylor said. We're stuck in this world with despotic leadership and lack of good governance, and somehow companies fly above the fray. The entire structure, the modus operandi of these companies in certain places, in certain corrupt places, is to be involved in illicit transfers of funds. Whether they're illegal or not is a different matter. As Dodd-Frank raced toward passage in 2010, no amount of lobbying from the big oil companies could unhorse the Section 1504 rider. Law firms serving the industry began preparing client alerts, explaining that it might soon be time to set up systems to track all payments to foreign governments and foreign officials, even if there were 500 contracts to sort through in a little place like Equatorial Guinea. Beyond that, the lawyers warned, new SEC rules for Section 1504 might require the reports to be posted online, available to the public. Hunton and Williams attorneys would counsel if the legislation passed that affected companies should thus begin preparing for any potential public relations issues that may arise out of the public disclosure of payments of the type contemplated by Dodd-Frank. Positively disgusted by that prospect, Rex Tillerson decided it was time to act. ExxonMobil had been dispatching its lobbyists over to Capitol Hill to argue against this legislation since Lugar's bill was first introduced, and continued after the Lugar-Cardin measure became Section 1504 of Dodd-Frank. But the damn thing was still alive. So one day in early 2010, in between picking up awards in Houston and dealing with the Deepwater Horizon fallout and trying to close deals with the oil czar Igor Sechin for big new joint ventures with Russia, Rex Tillerson finally decided that he would just do it himself. He flew to Washington, and he got himself a one-on-one meeting with the architect of Section 1504, Senator Richard Lugar. One of Lugar's key staff members on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Jay Brannigan, was in the room that day and could tell that quashing this little transparency movement meant a lot to Tillerson. He was the only CEO to come in to lobby personally, Brannigan later told a reporter. Tillerson tried to explain to Lugar that forcing American companies to report all these foreign payments and divulge specific dollar amounts would disadvantage ExxonMobil in its competition against oil companies from other countries. And somebody at that meeting would remember in vivid detail that when Senator Lugar said he wasn't going to stand down on Section 1504, the ExxonMobil CEO did something altogether unexpected and uncharacteristic. Rex Tillerson lost his cool. He got red-faced angry, that person told The New Yorker's Dexter Filkins in 2017. Tillerson denied this, but Filkins' source was adamant. He lifted out of his chair in anger. My impression was that he was not used to people with different views. Another thing still remembered long after that meeting was this. Tillerson listed a number of his and the industry's objections to the bill, Brannigan would tell a reporter, including that it would harm Exxon's relations with Russia. Chapter 10. Who does that? Marquette Road in Montclair, New Jersey, was the sort of suburban, tree-lined street designed to discourage unwanted bustle and traffic. The road itself was just a third of a mile long, a slow arc of unlined pavement, neatly edged with Belgian block, ending in a tight little circle of a cul-de-sac, which meant Marquette Road led to nowhere. Unless, of course, you lived in one of the three dozen mid-century colonial-slash-split-level houses on the street. If that were the case, then Marquette Road led home, and happily so. The street was always quiet, the sidewalks straight and mostly smooth. The houses were set back from the road at a respectful remove, so the yards were ample, and each was diligently mowed and landscaped after the American middle-class fashion, with easy-to-maintain plants and shrubs and bushes that you could pick up on a Saturday or a Sunday at the Home Depot, a convenient few miles away, just the other side of the Garden State Parkway. Not much unexpected happened on Marquette Road, which is the way everybody there seemed to prefer it. The same cars pulled in and out at regular hours most workdays. The same people walked their dogs, on leash, up and down the sidewalk. The same children came bounding down the block every afternoon on the way home from the school bus stop just around the corner. When somebody new moved in, it didn't take long for an ad hoc welcome wagon to come knocking with some wine or flowers or sundry genial offers. We have a teenager who babysits. And it didn't take long to become familiar with the daily rhythms of the new residents. Take the Murphy family, who had just moved into the boxy beige 1950s-era four-bedroom colonial, $481,000. Anybody could look it up on Zillow. In August 2008, just when a new school year was about to kick off, the Murphys seemed like something of a cliché in the New York suburbs. Solidly middle-class, middle-aged professionals, willing to give up the easier commute for an extra bedroom or two, a real yard, and, of course, the promise of good schools for their two young daughters. Probably the house was a stretch for the Murphys financially, the way things looked. After almost 2 years in Montclair, the couple still hadn't traded up for something better than their 12-year-old Honda Civic. Richard Murphy was a stay-at-home dad. He wasn't what you'd call outgoing or friendly, but he was polite, and he seemed like a man who could be counted on. He escorted his two daughters, Katie and Lisa, to the bus stop every morning and saw them off the big yellow school bus in the afternoons. He knew his way around a hamburger grill. He mowed his own lawn. He favored Coors Light. His wife, Cynthia, was clearly the breadwinner of the family. She took the DeCamp commuter bus number 66 into Port Authority every weekday morning and went to her office at a financial services company down near Wall Street, where she spent most of her time doling out tax advice and investment advice to high-end clients. And this was New York, so high-end also meant well-connected in business and political circles. Cynthia Murphy was already gaining a reputation among her small group of friends on Marquette Road for her wide-ranging and thoroughgoing competencies. She had just earned her MBA from Columbia University, but she also knew her way around the kitchen. "Oh, I had your lemon squares at the block party," Cynthia exclaimed to one neighbor. "I wanted to get the recipe." And she knew her way around the garden, too. Mrs. Murphy was a wizard with hydrangeas. The budding star of the family, however, was Katie Murphy, aged 11. She could be seen often with her sister in tow, riding down the block on her blue bicycle, her blonde pigtails athwart in the wind, or chalking out princess stories on the sidewalk, or manning her lemonade stand, or stopping to make a fuss over her neighbor's dog, the extra fluffy Casehound. Katie had been a distinguished participant, maybe the distinguished participant, at her recent fifth grade graduation ceremony. "I was just struck at how accomplished she was," another parent later told reporters after the whole unlikely story of the Murphys began to emerge. They called her up to the stage and said, "Stay right here. You're getting more awards." It was right around the time of Katie Murphy's impressive fifth grade graduation in June 2010 that Marquette Road began to take on a slightly different aspect. And you didn't have to be a nosy Parker to suss it out. Something was amiss. The traffic patterns were different, for starters. A number of unfamiliar cars parked up and down the street. One driver sat in a parked sedan down near the cul-de-sac for an hour and a half or more, which was a damn sight longer than any car service guy would wait around for a tardy client who had a reservation for a ride to Newark Airport. Gas company trucks were digging up the street, too. Though nobody on the block had smelled gas, and nobody had called the company as far as anybody knew. There was also a smattering of people the neighbors had never seen, strolling up and down Marquette Road, walking unfamiliar dogs. And then all of a sudden, the last Sunday in June, the street was crawling with black Ford LTDs. Who drives a Ford LTD in 2010? The arrests themselves happened in a hurry. The FBI and whatever other law enforcement agents were involved descended on 31 Marquette Road with all deliberate efficiency, because they knew Richard and Cynthia Murphy were at home for the taking. So was their younger daughter, 9-year-old Lisa. There was, however, a little glitch. Katie wasn't there. She arrived home a few hours after the raid commenced, entirely unaware of the unfolding kerfuffle. She was carrying an animal balloon party favor from the birthday shindig she had just attended. Family friends escorted Katie and Lisa out of their house later that same evening. The teenage girl next door described the scene for one of the many reporters who would shortly arrive on Marquette Road. She said the young girls were in a state of obvious confusion and fear when they walked out the front door of the house carrying backpacks and clutching pillows. The neighbor girl also described watching Richard and Cynthia Murphy being taken from the house in handcuffs, no doubt headed for jail. Cynthia remained composed even as she was paraded out past her hydrangeas and all the gawkers. She was like, "Okay, I know exactly what this is, and I'm not saying anything," the neighbor remembered. "I have pride." The Murphys were not the only suspects rolled up in what turned out to be the capper of a 10-year-long FBI counterintelligence investigation. This was a full-on sleeper cell spy ring. The captured co-conspirators numbered 10, all with similarly nondescript aliases and covers. Don Heathfield and his wife, Tracy Foley, were Canadians who had moved to Boston about 10 years earlier with their two sons. Heathfield had a master's degree from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and worked as an international consultant specializing in leadership and management. Tracy Foley, his wife, worked in real estate. Juan Lazaro was a citizen of Peru who occasionally taught a college course in Latin American politics and lived in Yonkers with his wife, Vicky Pelaez, a firebrand columnist for a Spanish-language newspaper. Their 17-year-old son was already gaining a reputation as a classical concert pianist in the making. Michael Zottoli and his wife Patricia Mills both had business degrees from the University of Washington in Seattle. They had recently moved with their two toddlers across the country to the Washington, D.C. suburbs in hopes of landing jobs in or around the federal government. Mikhail Semenko was also living in the D.C. suburbs, working at a travel agency. Just 28 years old, Semenko had recently completed a master's degree in international relations / Asian studies and an internship at the World Affairs Councils of America in Washington. He also had a bang-up LinkedIn page, which to this day still reads, "Highly creative and analytical professional with recent education and diverse experience involving development assistance, meeting and event planning, partnership building, and high-level client relations. Natural leader and communicator with in-depth knowledge of government policy research." The co-conspirator who captured the greatest portion of the media attention in the days following the dragnet was the youngest and, honestly, the most attractive of the suspects. Her name was Anna Chapman. Cynthia Murphy's business-like competency, her prize hydrangeas and her lemon squares, were no match in the press for Anna Chapman's flaming auburn hair and her youthful allure, which netted the 28-year-old a week's worth of covers and headlines. In the always editorially tumescent New York Post, it was 00 heaven. The leggy redhead was billed as a modern seductress worthy of Mata Hari. Her ex-husband back in London, Alex Chapman, fanned the flames by sharing with the sleaziest tabloid then on record, News of the World, racy photos of Anna and tales of sex romps involving nipple clamps and whips. "Anna was great in bed and she knew exactly what to do," said the jilted ex-husband. "She was awesome." A subsequent boyfriend and sugar daddy in London told other reporters he was very, very shocked to see this news. He said it never crossed his mind that she was a spy. The same could be said by any of the Murphys' friends and neighbors on Marquette Road. "It never crossed my mind. They were spies." But the neighbors watched the whirlwind post-arrest legal proceedings and began to understand something quite extraordinary had transpired right there on their sleepy little road. "Sometimes," one of the elders on the block told a New York reporter, "sometimes things make sense to you after the fact." The 10 defendants were arraigned in federal district court, charged with money laundering and conspiring to act as unregistered agents of a foreign government. All but one was held without bail. The final disposition didn't take long. The Murphys and their co-defendants were back in court less than 2 weeks later to plead guilty to the charges. The federal judge in Manhattan, at the urging of the U.S. Department of Justice, sentenced the defendants to time served, 11 days so far, and then ordered them deported. "The agreement we reached today," announced Attorney General Eric Holder, "provides a successful resolution for the United States and its interests." The media tracked the Boeing 767 carrying the Murphys and the others to a remote runway at the main airport in Vienna, Austria, where it rendezvoused with a second plane. The two aircraft idled nose to tail on the tarmac for a little more than an hour, while a secure bus shuttled in between, swapping out the 10 foreign agents arrested in America for 4 soon-to-be imports to the West. A spies-for-spies trade between Moscow and Washington, a full-blooded Cold War throwback. Less than 3 hours after taking off from Vienna, the Russian Yakovlev Yak-42 jet touched down in Moscow. The Murphys and their co-conspirators were home again, back in Russia after almost 20 years in the United States for some of them. They were received in general triumph, which included a ceremony a few months later at the Kremlin, where the Russian president Dmitry Medvedev presented the talented adventurers with special award citations. Prime Minister and soon-to-be president again Vladimir Putin promised a bright and happy future back home in the motherland for them all. The bosses in the Russian intelligence service took the celebrated secret agents on a victory tour, which reportedly culminated at Putin's villa on the Black Sea. Anna Chapman later told acquaintances that the former KGB agent, Vladimir Putin, gave her a ride into the deepest lake in the world, Lake Baikal, in his personal submarine. According to press reports out of Russia, anyway, most of the illegals settled into the bright and happy future they were promised. only the Murphys disappeared into oblivion. Mikhail Semenko? He went to work in the Moscow office of the same travel agency he'd worked for in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. He didn't even have to update his LinkedIn page. Natalia Periverzeva, armed with her business degree from the University of Washington, became an advisor on international projects to the CEO of Russia's powerful oil pipeline company, Transneft. The most impressive of the new professional assignments went to Donald Heathfield, a.k.a. Andrei Bezrukhov, who had compiled the finest record of almost accomplishment among the whole spy team. Not long after he and the other illegals completed their weird Putin-led victory tour, Bezrukhov was awarded a job at the jewel in the crown of Russia's state-controlled corporations, Rosneft, which would shortly surpass ExxonMobil in pure size and breadth. The appointment was made, it was reported in the Russian press, as per orders from above. But nobody made out like Anna Chapman, that auburn-haired latter-day Mata Hari. She landed a job as advisor to a Russian investment bank specializing in high tech and aerospace. That said, the job had no fixed office hours, and consequently, Anna Chapman had free rein to exploit her Kremlin-powered celebrity to its fullest. Chapman appeared on the cover of the Russian edition of Maxim, wearing lingerie and holding a Beretta pistol. She launched a fashion line, a perfume, a poker app, and a weekly television show called Secrets of the World with Anna Chapman. She drove a sleek black Porsche Cayenne. She frequented high-profile nightclubs in Moscow. She drew hordes of paparazzi at movie premieres. Ms. Chapman even tweeted a marriage proposal to Moscow-ensconced American defector Edward Snowden a few years back. And she maintains a Western-friendly social media profile. Her Twitter feed quotes Winston Churchill, Albert Einstein, the Dalai Lama, Oscar Wilde, John Stuart Mill. There are many truths of which the full meaning cannot be realized until personal experience has brought it home. And she remains, above all, a loyal and patriotic Russian who briefly led the young guard of Putin's United Russia political party. Anna is Putin's girl, one Kremlin watcher told the reporter for Politico, Brett Forrest. The way the illegal story was told inside Russia, this 10-person cell of deep cover spies had done extraordinary work in the United States, uncovering a trove of useful intelligence while successfully pulling the wool over the eyes of the CIA and the FBI. Andrei Soldatov, a Moscow-born journalist who specializes in Russian security services, explained to Brett Forrest at Politico a little more than a year after the return of the spies, "Nobody in Russia thinks they were a failure. It's a victory because it shows we can still compete with America. We are a great power. We can do everything we want to do." Russia's great victory was not conceded here in the United States. The spies were caught, right? And without much trouble. And yet their story did make for a fantastic tale. The saga of these deep cover agents spooling out in official legal filings and news accounts offered tantalizing hints of intrigue and peril and old school spycraft at work. The senior of the key suspects had been trained by the old Soviet KGB, the younger by the KGB's Russian successor in foreign intelligence, the SVR. But these were not your garden variety agents. The 10 Russians captured in the U.S. in 2010 were modern inheritors of a long and storied history of Russian illegals. Among spies, illegals are a special breed of cat, long known for their sophistication and flair, as one Russian counterintelligence expert put it, assiduously prepared for long years on foreign assignment, pretending not to be Russians at all. At the beginning of their careers, they had received training in the language and culture of the country they would inhabit. They were taught the basics of identifying and communicating with their fellow travelers, how to execute a brush pass, how to non-verbally signal danger to a comrade, how to send radiograms, how to cipher and decipher coded messages, and more recently, in the age of the internet, how to join a temporary wireless network or operate software to pull encrypted data off innocuous-looking public websites. Once trained, illegals were shipped off on assignments around the world, including to the United States, often as married couples, always armed with legends, stolen identities, and invented backstories to work the long game. They did not gather foreign intelligence while safely under the guise of factotums at Russian embassies and consulates and trade missions, working in broad daylight with the promise of diplomatic immunity if they were caught in acts of espionage. They instead lived like locals. As locals, they moved into American communities and made friends, went to graduate school and made new friends, got jobs and made new friends, had children and made new friends. The newest generation still operated as their predecessors had in the early days of Soviet spydom, switching on and off multiple taxis, buses, and subways to shake real or perceived surveillance, exercising discretion in all ways. Their cars, by official edict, should not be pricier or nicer than those of embassy workers who are of equal or higher rank than the station chief. They were constantly on guard against slip-ups that might get them reassigned to some godforsaken outpost in Siberia or demoted to a job in internal security where they would end up spying on Moscow dentist offices or St. Petersburg tennis clubs. Most of all, they waited for and followed the coded instructions from SVR's Directorate S, whose chief ran the 2010 version of Russia's non-traditional espionage program. Try to single out tidbits unknown publicly but revealed in private by sources close to State Department, government, major think tanks. That was the kind of routine order from on high that was ultimately detailed in the U.S. Justice Department's federal criminal complaint against the illegals. Their assignments in the United States were actually pretty cushy during the first decade after the breakup of the Soviet Union. While their countrymen back in Russia fought for their economic survival, the Murphys and the Heathfields and the Zottolis lived in the land of plenty, with money to pay exorbitant graduate school tuitions and without a lot of heat from their bosses back at Moscow Center. Instructions from Directorate S were spotty and general and not particularly urgent right up to the early years of the 21st century, just after Vladimir Putin took over the Russian presidency. Putin was happy to allow the U.S. to pony up for oil pipelines and tanker-friendly deepwater ports in Russia. He was more than thrilled to have the bankers at Morgan Stanley shake the Western money tree on behalf of Russian companies. He was quick to boast of the world-beating economic growth that foreign investment engendered in Russia. But the old KGB man would never let go of his suspicion of the United States of America and its insatiable